Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review, where we highlight legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. We are your hosts, Adri Langemeyer and Robert Cunningham.
And special thanks to our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 13 offices and more than 750 lawyers, committed to excellence in serving its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse experiences and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's summer associate program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins.
Travis Torrance serves as the Global Litigation, Bankruptcy, and Credit Team Lead for Shell Oil Company. He manages a team handling bankruptcy and credit legal issues for all of Shell's business units in the U.S. and Canada. In 2019, Torrance was recognized as a rising star in the area of bankruptcy by Texas Super Lawyers and was a 2016 Houston Business Journal 40 Under 40 honoree and a finalist in the publication's Best Corporate Counsel Awards. He was recently appointed to serve on the board of directors for the Texas Access to Justice Foundation, a nonprofit that provides grant funding for civil legal aid in Texas. Travis and I talked about how a college dean helped encourage him to reach higher than he thought possible, the time he met Maya Angelou, and the philosophy he carries as a leader today. We're so excited to have you. You've led such an interesting and unique life, and I can't wait to share it with our listeners. So I'm going to dive in, and we'll start where we always start, which is at the beginning. Travis, where were you born and where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Kenner, Louisiana, which is actually a suburb of New Orleans. It's about 15 minutes west of the New Orleans Central Business District. And Adri, I don't know if you've ever flown into New Orleans, but the airport is actually located in Kenner. And it was really a remarkable place for me to grow up because it at least felt like it was a really diverse place. I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood with kids of different races. The neighbors across the street were this amazing same-sex couple and so on. But what I didn't really realize is that my parents were working really hard for me to have the experience of a feeling like I was surrounded by diversity. Because if you take a step back and think about where Kenner's located on the map, it's the same parish that sent David Duke to the House of Representatives in Louisiana. I was also, like, coincidentally, the first Black person to become valedictorian of my high school and the school's history. And to add another layer of complexity to that, you know, unfortunately, a teacher was shot by a student the year before I started high school at that school. And so Kenner was a really complex place, but my parents and my family worked really, really hard to make sure that I had a good experience growing up as a kid.
Wow. So I have two thoughts immediately as you were sharing that. And one is that it reminds me a lot of Houston as well. And maybe that's just part of being in the South and on the coast, is that they're very diverse areas. It sounds like that has a very heavy influence of both diverse communities, but also like Southern values that are constantly in conflict. So that is, it really does give you such a unique background and understanding of the world. And I'm curious how that growing up that way influenced your career path and who you are today.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I've thought a lot about it because, again, back to my parents, I watched them work incredibly hard. And my mom was a school teacher and my dad was a truck driver. And I've said this before, but I'm the great grandson of Mississippi sharecroppers and the great great grandson of slaves who worked the lands in Louisiana. And my parents consistently told me that they wanted a better life for me. And I heard it all the time, especially, Adri, when I wasn't applying myself or trying hard enough in school, and they saw through it. But I distinctly remember the first day of college, my parents sat me down to reiterate that message. And they said, Travis, hey, we're making major sacrifices so that you can make a better life for yourself. But this time they followed it up with the Winston Churchill quote that you might have heard before that goes, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give. Mm. So I knew that whatever I chose to do, whether it was medicine or the law or engineering, I needed to use it to at least try to leave the world a better place than I found it in some form or fashion, which eventually led to me going to college and, as you know, becoming a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, and it's so amazing because, you know, that's a lot of weight to carry on your shoulders as a young person, but also so incredibly motivating to have that perspective and to go into something where you're going to work hard, but you know it's to get something more out of it and to build another brick on top of what your parents had already established. So kind of turning from that, where did you end up going to undergrad and what did you study there?
So I went to Tulane, which is also in New Orleans. I lived at home during my freshman year since it was only 15 minutes away from campus. And my immediate perception was, and you sort of pointed this out a little bit, although I grew up in a really diverse place 15 minutes away from campus, when I got to campus, my immediate perception was that Tulane was not a diverse place at all. Again, I was the only Black person in my graduating class of Tulane College, which was at the time the all-male liberal arts school at Tulane. However, I still had a really remarkable experience there. And to answer your question directly, I studied communication and political science. Those were my two majors.
Yeah. And I noted in another interview that you did that you became the president of your fraternity, which had previously been an all-white fraternity. Did I get that right?
You did. I was a brother of Zeta Psi fraternity. Mm-hmm. And during my time at Tulane, I was the only Black brother, and I ascended to being president of that chapter. So I was really involved in Greek life. I was really involved in life on campus otherwise, but it gave me just such a unique perspective mm-hmm. into the minds of my classmates. And I think when I got to Tulane, I had a choice to make. I could be a person who felt like I didn't belong, or I could really try to get to know my classmates and also give them an opportunity to get to know me. And I developed some of my best friends for life in that fraternity. And interestingly enough, or at least I thought it was interesting, one day I was driving down Broadway, which is Fraternity Row at Tulane, and one of my fraternity brothers said, "You're actually the first Black person who I've had an opportunity to talk to."
Wow.
Like, there were Black kids at his high school, like a handful maybe, but mm-hmm. he had never had a real conversation with a Black person. And that was just extraordinary to me, but it was really a unique opportunity for people to break down barriers and get to know and learn from and about one another.
Yeah. And I love just that perspective that you took, because sometimes it can be really scary to be the pioneer at something or to be the first, you know, to kind of break through. And like, you were the first Black man on your campus and in your fraternity. That can be a scary thing. And you didn't shy away from that and the opportunity that it gave. And I think that's very inspiring to hear about. So in your time at Tulane, you were already studying poli-sci. Did you have plans for a legal career while you were there at school?
So this is actually a funny story, or at least I think it's funny. When I was in college, I thought I'd finish and become a news reporter and hopefully ultimately an anchor on the news. And I even sought out an internship at a radio station, which led to my first real job as an on-air personality while I was still in college. But it was my mom, who was a high school math teacher, who said, "Hey, Travis, I've taught you lots of equations throughout your life. I'm going to teach you probably the most important one yet, and that is communication plus political science equals unemployed. So what is going to be your real game plan here? What is your end game? Because we're not making these sacrifices for you to get into this competitive industry where there aren't many roads to success. So I thought back to that message of service, and you know, when people need help, who do they turn to? Mm-hmm. In many instances, they call lawyers. And the law for me, at least at that age, I thought, hey, it organizes and adds structure to society and our behaviors. It can incentivize certain actions and deter others. And if I understand it, I'll be in a better position to help myself and to help others, actually.
Wow. Well, big thanks to your mom. That was some helpful advice and good that you took it from her. It reminds me a lot of my mom. I come from a working class family as well. And it was definitely a big message growing up that, you know, you need to think practically and not just live on dreams, even though they did teach me to reach for my dreams too. And that actually brings me to my next question, because I read somewhere that you had planned to apply to law schools locally, but a dean at your college encouraged you to go ahead and to apply to Ivy League schools as well. And I was just curious about that, because I think, as you know, for me, a first generation college student and law student, sometimes we can be self-limiting in seeing what our opportunities are. And it sometimes takes that person outside of the scope of our world to let us know that, hey, there are actually bigger things that you can reach for. And I was just curious if that was a similar scenario for you in applying to law school.
That's actually a remarkable point. This is truly the story of how people sometimes see more in you than you see in yourself. And that person's name was Dean Jean Danielson, and she was the head of the Honors College at Tulane. And I needed her to sign a form for my law school applications. And I remember that afternoon, I barged into her office, I plopped the form down on her desk, and I pointed to the signature line. And she told me, as she often did, "Travis, slow down and have a seat." And she said, "Hey, we've never really talked about law school, but I think that's a good choice for you. Where do you want to go for law school?" And I said that I had intended to stay in Louisiana because, first of all, it's all that I knew. I hadn't lived anywhere else. And also, my mom had recently died of cancer. And so Dean Jean said, "Well, you know, why not Harvard or Yale or some of the other Ivy League schools?" And I used the same line or refrain about my family needed me, not having the money to go to those schools. But secretly, I was so scared of rejection. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that I was competitive. And even if I got into those schools, clearly those kids were much smarter than me and I'd mm-hmm. never finish. And thank goodness for Dean Jean. She was so perceptive and she saw right through that. And she said, "Hey, look, we don't have to tell anybody where you're applying to school, but just apply to at least one of the Ivy League schools. Do it for me. You're at the top of your class at Tulane and you have nothing to lose." And so I ended up applying to about 13 or 14 schools, including Harvard and Yale. Ended up getting into all of them and going to Yale Law School, and following her advice to apply to the Ivy League schools was some of the best advice ever given. And it's so great that she was able to see what was going on with mm-hmm. me. And she perceived that I was scared of rejection and I had never really lost anything. And so it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. And now there's a scholarship in Dean Jean's name at Tulane that I make contributions to on a yearly basis because she changed my life.
That is so wonderful. It's such a great story. And sometimes it really only takes that one person to see that spark in you and to encourage it and kind of help it grow into a flame. Well, you did end up at Yale Law School. And did your whole law school experience there and did great as a student there as well. And I'm curious, outside of learning the law, which is what you were there to do, what did you take away from your time at law school?
So let me start by saying that I did not learn the law at Yale Law School. Anybody who's gone there will tell you you're not going to learn any law there. and that was true of my experience too. But I learned a few things. The first is, you know, this was the first time that I was completely on my own. And if I could make it driving through snow, I had never done that before, cooking for myself, cleaning an apartment, and doing well in school, I just might be able to do this thing called life after all. I also met some of the best friends of my life there from all over the world. But I learned from that when you build relationships authentically, they can endure and they can help you professionally and otherwise, but you really have to be willing to put in the effort to making them work. And for your listeners who are out in private practice right now, or for your listeners who are still in law school or thinking about law school, your first opportunity to build the skills as a recruiter or developing business, that starts with getting to know your colleagues in law school. It starts very early on because those are the people that are going to know about the job opportunities. Those are the people who are going to be sending you work if they end up in-house, and you want them to have a good perception of who you are as a person. And just a quick shout out, two of my really good friends are on the faculty at the University of Houston, Jessica Roberts, who teaches health law and subjects that are ancillary to that, and Daniel Morales, were both my classmates at Yale, and
oh my gosh,
love seeing them.
That is so cool, so awesome, and such an important thing to keep in mind because, you know, as we know, law schools can sometimes just the culture there can end up pitting you against one another, and it's important to keep that at the front of mind that like these are not just people I'm competing against for a grade. These are my future colleagues, people Indeed. That will be in my legal community possibly for the rest of my life. And it is so, so important to build those relationships at that early stage. And awesome shout out to our UH professors. We love them. So after law school, you went and you clerked for the Honorable Edward C. Prado? Am I saying that incorrectly?
Prado. Yes, Judge Prado.
Okay, Judge Prado at the Fifth Circuit, which is, you know, such an important experience that not everybody gets to have is clerking after law school. So what did you gain from that experience? And is there any advice you could give to students currently who are hoping to clerk?
Well, first of all, clerking was the most fun legal job that I've ever had. And just to put it into context, I got to do some really cool stuff as an associate at Fulbright. I'm sure we're going to talk about that in a second. And I get to do some really, really cool stuff for Shell Oil Company. But working for Judge Prado was the opportunity of a lifetime. And although I still call him Judge Prado, he retired from the federal bench a few years ago and now works in the Trump administration as the ambassador to Argentina. Oh, so wow. Now he's in Buenos Aires. And I was in Argentina maybe 2 years ago, and I visited Judge Prado and his lovely wife, Maria. They took me on this tour with my partner and three of my friends who were in Argentina with me on a tour of the ambassador's residence. And then we went to a great lunch. But that brings me to my first point. Clerking gave me a lifelong mentor and a lifelong friend, someone who was high up in the federal judiciary. And whenever I have an important decision to make about my career or my life, Judge Prado is like a second father, and I don't make any moves without at least talking to him about what I'm considering. The other thing is pretty obvious. I was able to really hone my research and writing skills. And also, you read so many briefs from so many different types of lawyers that you get to see what's effective and what's not. Right. And the same is true of oral argument as well, because we were flying to New Orleans once a month to watch the attorneys in action. in oral argument. The other thing you get is an understanding of the federal court system and what happens after you press submit on your brief. Where does it go from there, right? Yeah. And it's really helpful to understand that. A quick story, I was a second year lawyer and I was working on this bankruptcy appeal that went directly to the Fifth Circuit. And we hadn't accounted for getting official citations to the official record. And that record was located in New Orleans. So I flew to New Orleans really quickly, knew that I needed to go to the clerk's office to check out the record. Thank goodness, one of my last acts as a law clerk was helping one of my best friends who lived in New Orleans, where I grew up, to get a job in the clerk's office. So that made the issue of checking out the record and getting everything and getting copies so much easier because I had connections that I had made during my clerkship in the clerk's office. But the last thing that I want to focus on from my clerkship year before sort of talking about some of the advice for people who are interested in clerking is that on any given day or any given week, I would see Social Security issues. I would see immigration issues about the removal of people from our country. We got to work on death penalty issues. We worked on complex commercial issues, civil rights issues. That breadth of legal issues that you see will make you forget about doubting yourself. You will know that you can research and learn about just about any practice area and that you've honed your writing skills to write for three judge panels and for the public and the press to understand those opinions as well. So what I gained from all of that is that at the end of it, I felt like no matter what the law threw at me, I'd be able to handle it. So again, another boost of confidence. But the advice part that you asked me about, when I went to law school, I was a first generation lawyer, no other lawyers in my family, a few friends of the family, distant friends of the family happened to be lawyers. I had no idea that clerking was even a thing. I think we need to talk to people who are thinking about law students. We need to talk to law students about these opportunities that they're going to be faced with much earlier on in their legal careers. I think there's something that we as employers can do. I know that there's a clerkship bonus out there to sort of make you whole if you're thinking of going into big law afterwards. But one of the most difficult things for me as a first generation lawyer was explaining to my dad that I was going to go and clerk for a federal judge versus starting at a large law firm. And I think that helping people through those conversations, giving them the tools to make sure that not only they understand why they're doing it, but their families, because I was helping to support my family after law school, right? And they were wondering why I was taking this $42,000 per year job versus $160,000. And I think we really, really need to do a better job of educating people about the benefits of clerking and that credential and what it'll do for you going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such a huge point, especially if you're a first generation law student, or just don't have a lot of support coming from your family or you're supporting your family, is the fact that clerking opens doors down the road. And a lot of things that we do in law school and after law school, whether it's building relationships and mentorships and all of these are things that benefit you potentially at the same moment, but most of the time it's down the road. And when you're thinking about how you're going to support your family, it's hard to think about how is this going to benefit me down the road versus what is going to benefit me right now. And I think you're so right. And UH Law thankfully has a great pipeline program that I'm part of, but we need more breadth in that area of educating undergrad and even high school students that are thinking about a legal career of, you know, these opportunities that are out there and how they benefit them on the whole. So thank you for sharing about that experience. It sounds fantastic. And I hope that others will be inspired by that and look into clerking as well. I'm going to shift now from your clerkship experience. You went to Norton Rose Fulbright, which it was probably not Norton Rose Fulbright at that time.
It was Fulbright Jaworski, actually.
Okay, Fulbright Jaworski in 2006. And you were there for several years. You actually became a senior associate there.
And you ended up in the bankruptcy practice. So I want to start there. How did you end up doing bankruptcy work? How does that work when you come into a big law firm and you get, you know, put into an area? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I had the fortunate opportunity to be a summer associate at three different law firms in my second summer of law school. So I was a law clerk at Fulbright and Jaworski, Baker Botts, and the law firm that now goes to market is Locke Lord. It was Locke, Liddell, and Sapp at the time. And at all three firms, I asked to do bankruptcy work. And I'll take a step back. My dad is probably one of those embarrassing dads that makes crazy jokes all the time. But whenever I introduce myself today as a bankruptcy lawyer, one of his favorite things to do is to interrupt me and say, since Travis said he was going to law school, I knew he was going to be a bankruptcy lawyer. And people give him this baffled look and they go on and they play along and say, well, how'd you know? And he says, because since Travis was born, he's been dealing with broke people, from me and his mom to his friends right now. And then he goes on and he takes it too far and says he probably should have specialized in criminal law because his cousins on his mom's side of the family could keep him really busy doing that work. Crazy embarrassing, right? But the real reason I chose to do bankruptcy law is because I had this amazing professor. And his name is Eric Brunstad, and he was an adjunct professor. I think he's actually teaching a class at Yale right now. But he works for a large law firm, but in the afternoons, he would drive to New Haven and teach us either bankruptcy 101, secure transactions, and advanced reorganizations. And I took all three of those classes with him. And not only is he extraordinarily handsome, but he was really excited and passionate about the work that he did during the day as a bankruptcy practitioner. And I compared that or contrasted that to my other professors and how they really cared about the research and writing they were doing in their office and less so about the substantive subject matters they were teaching us. I said, well, I want to do what this guy's doing because he seems really excited and passionate. So as a summer associate, I asked for bankruptcy work, and it really resonated with my personality. And that's because bankruptcy emerged from the courts of equity. So there are these equitable principles, these fairness principles that are really intuitive to me. So the other thing is that, Adrie, I don't know if you've ever seen a bankruptcy lawyer, but we carry around these little books that are called mini codes, and it's the bankruptcy code in this sort of little tiny book. And saw it and I said, well, hey, I think I could memorize that thing. And I know that my practice won't be easy, but at least I'll be a step ahead of all of the case law and jurisprudence and all of the other practice areas that are being thrown my way. And that was a mistake and a very naive perspective, but I'm glad that I made that mistake because what I realized after starting as a bankruptcy lawyer, that little mini code has so many references to other state and federal laws. And so you're really dealing with labor and employment issues. You're dealing with risk and insurance issues. You're dealing with tax issues. You're dealing with the full gamut of legal issues that all of the other practice areas are having to deal with. Mm-hmm. The other cool thing about bankruptcy is you are constantly learning about different industries and different businesses. Because if you think about debtors, they come from the energy sector, they come from banking, they come from real estate. So you're constantly learning how these different industries make their money, the mistakes that people are making, that are losing the money. And that was really fascinating to me. So that's how I ended up becoming a bankruptcy lawyer and also sticking with it throughout the vast majority of my career.
Well, and I think it's so interesting, you know, areas of law like bankruptcy and IP comes to mind as well. There are these kind of niches that cross both transactional and litigation practice. So as you began your practice at Norton Rose, or I cannot, Fulbright Jaworski. Okay, I'm gonna...
Right. Yeah, it was Fulbright and Jaworski, but you can call it either. They know what you're talking about.
when you started at Norton Rose and you were there for those many years, were you doing a mix of transactional and litigation practice as well?
I was. And so when you think about bankruptcy, those attorneys who represent primarily debtors and banks often end up doing quite a bit more transactional work than litigation, because you're trying to think of how you're going to restructure this business and refinance their debt, sell their assets, which is largely things of a transactional nature. Mm-hmm. If you represent unsecured creditors and sometimes secured creditors, your practice is generally more litigation oriented. But most bankruptcy attorneys have quite a bit of a mix of skills in both transactional and corporate type work, as well as litigation. And so I was doing a mix of both, and it was a great place to sort of grind my teeth and get to know a variety of different legal skills.
Yeah, and a great foundation for eventually going in-house, which we'll be talking about shortly. But in your formative legal years while you were at Norton Rose, did you develop any other mentor relationships along the way?
I did. I had several mentors. Bill Greendike, who I'll tell you a little bit more about in a second, but he was the chief bankruptcy judge for the Southern District of Texas, who lateraled over to become a partner at Fulbright about a year or two before I joined the firm as an associate. Ann Rogers, who's a phenomenal antitrust litigator and class actions litigator, who's still at Fulbright. Shauna Clark, who is the chair of Norton Rose Fulbright in the U.S. and the first Black woman actually to be the chair of a global law firm, also one of my mentors. But, you know, Bill and I started working together and developed a relationship because he lived out in Katy. And to fight the commute, he would get to work really, really early.
Okay.
And I'm also a bit of an early bird. I wake up very early in the morning. I'd get to work early, and all of the other associates would kind of come in closer to 9. Mm-hmm. And Bill and I were there about 6:30 or 7. And I had just come off of my judicial clerkship with the Fifth Circuit. And Bill walked into my office one day and said, "Hey, do you know how to use Westlaw? Can you like pull this case for me?" And he came in the office with the specific citation, right? I thought he was gonna like make me do some research. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "You're paying me $160,000 a year. I better be able to pull this case." So I pulled the case for him, sent him the electronic draft, and also brought a paper copy of the case to him. The next morning he came in with a research assignment. That was followed up by writing a memo, and then we started writing pleadings, and I worked my way up to doing almost all of my work with him. And he was a wonderful, wonderful person to learn from in those early years of learning about the substantive practice of bankruptcy law. And I think the point here is people will tell you to find mentors, and it is easier said than done. Mm-hmm. What you really need to do is to think about what your mentor needs. Mm. Bill needed somebody who was going to start working at 6:30 or 7 and not 9 o'clock. I needed mentorship. And so we both grew from that relationship. We both got something from it. It was reciprocal. I think about one of my mentees who is a U of H law graduate. Mm-hmm. We met at this event that your career development services put on, and he reached out to me afterwards. We had coffee, and he asked me, it was a Thursday afternoon, "What was I doing over the weekend?" And I was like, "That's sort of a odd question, and I don't know where you're going with it." But I said, "Hey, I'm going to be doing some volunteer work for AIDS Foundation Houston." And he said, "Well, can I come and help you out with it?"
Oh, wow.
And I ended up saying, "Yeah, they could use all of the help that they can get." And we ended up working on that project together. And that gave me insight into his character and who he was as a person. He learned about me. He was doing something that I was interested in. And so this job came up at Shell. Of course, although I was mentoring 5 other people at the time, his name was at the top of the list because I knew him and had worked with him. So those relationships have to be reciprocal. And the other point that I'll make about mentorship is that once you find one mentor, don't stop there, because you'll realize that some people are good at business development. Other people are good at technical skills. Other people are great at professional development. Some people will teach you about balance. So create what I like to call a board of directors, people who are going to be able to give you good advice and counsel in the various areas of your life. And that's my goal. And today, to this date, I still have a board of directors who I call and consult with about major life decisions, as well as the stupid questions that I'm afraid to ask anyone else.
Yeah, I think that is such a wonderful analogy, and definitely one that I will be carrying forward as well, taking that board of directors mentality into mentorship relationships. So during these same years that you were at Norton Rose, you had the opportunity to meet Maya Angelou. And I was reading about this interaction that you had with her in one of your interviews, and she said some very important words to you that seems like really impacted you. She told you, well, I'll let you tell the story.
Okay. I was waiting for you. I'm like, you know this story.
Yes,
you're
I
actually
do.
Doing a better job at it than I could ever do. I think it was back in 2011. Maya Angelou was on tour, and I had somehow gotten tickets to hear her speak, but I also had VIP tickets to the meet and greet that she hosted before her talk. And at some point, a photographer came over and said, "Hey, Travis, are you ready for a picture with Dr. Maya Angelou?" And I turned and I was like, "Of course I'm ready for a picture with Dr. Maya Angelou. Like, that's why I'm here." The thing that you can't appreciate or can't see about me from the podcast is that I am 6 feet and 6 inches tall. And at the time, Maya Angelou was in a wheelchair and she was wearing these very dark sunglasses. And when I introduced myself, she was like, "Okay, now they're going to take a picture of us." And so I said to myself, well, if they're going to get both of us in the same frame, then I'm going to have to sort of stoop down by her wheelchair. So I started to do that. And she turned to me and she grabbed my hand and she said, "No, son, stand tall." And she said it in her deep, raspy voice. And at the time, Adrie, I was struggling with so many issues. But first and foremost, I was struggling with whether I was ready to come out as being a gay man at Norton Rose Fulbright in big law, right? I was also struggling with how to own my entire story that we've been talking about up to this point. And in that moment, I knew that I had to not only bring my whole self to work and the rest of my life, but I had to be proud of it too. And so those words, I'm not sure if she knew the impact that she'd be making on my life, but they just reverberated, and I can still hear them clear to this day.
Well, even hearing them now, and I've read them several times now, you know, it still gives me chills. And I want to take a moment to honor what you've said, because, you know, when we choose people for this podcast, they're always very accomplished individuals in the legal community in Houston or abroad. And I just want to take a moment to recognize the fact that we're talking about your whole story. And at this point in your story, you didn't have it all together. You were a Yale graduate and you had a fantastic job and already making a name for yourself in the legal community. But by your own admission, you didn't have it all together all the time. And I think it's important for our listeners to hear and recognize that it is a journey. And this moment in your journey was very impactful for you. And I hope that it will be impactful for others listening. So thank you for sharing that story with us.
Indeed, it is a journey. And what I'll also tell you is that there's always more than what meets the eye. So you might take a look at the bio and think that a person has it all figured out, but there's always more in the background, and people are dealing with some serious issues. You know, the law in and of itself, we have a higher rate of mental health issues and substance use issues. And so really getting to know people, and really, when you ask someone how they're doing, really pausing and listening and give them an opportunity to tell you exactly how they're doing. But I'm still trying to figure out this thing called life. And so thanks for allowing me to be imperfect today.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for sharing your imperfect, perfect self with us today. After your time at Norton Rose, you came on at Shell around 2013, and you've been at Shell essentially since then. So I'm curious first, what was that initial transition going in-house like for you after having been a clerk and then being in big law? It's a pretty big shift.
Oh, wow. It was a huge shift. And I think the biggest thing that was apparent to me early on was that I was no longer a part of the profit generating sector of the business. I was now a part of the cost, right? But after a while, you sort of realize that if you're really effective at your job, you're enabling the business to reach their goals faster, but in a legally compliant manner that reduces risk. And sometimes you can find money and contracts that's being left on the table. But in those early days, you realize that you are not the product anymore, right? The hydrocarbons in the ground are, or the wind energy that's being produced. And those scientists who are helping to bring that to the marketplace quickly, those are the people who are really making the money for the business, just like law firm partners and associates were doing in my previous context. I think the other thing that I realized is that my clients aren't going anywhere and I'm not going anywhere. And so you really have to work hard to develop and cultivate and sustain your client attorney relationships. Mm-hmm. Before, when I was in private practice, I was able to bounce around to different clients and to different industries. But if you work with the credit manager for the Americas, and that's your primary stakeholder, and he's in his job for 4 years, you're going to be in your job for at least 4 years, you have to manage that relationship. You have to make sure that you're remaining credible. You've got to make sure that you are giving your clients the advice that they need, not just what they want. And so that was important to learn. But I think the other thing that I realized that's probably most important and that served me well is that when I'm communicating with the business, you really need to use the vocabulary and the turns of phrases that the business uses. And even more importantly, you need to make your advice relatable to the bottom line. Mm-hmm. So when you're in a law firm, you can write a superficial memo that analyzes this very discreet legal issue. But if you ever read one of my email messages today, within the first two sentences, I'm talking about how my advice impacts the bottom line of Shell Oil Company. And if you're not doing that, you're missing the mark as an in-house attorney. And I think that there are lots of law firm attorneys who don't realize that that's what we're doing. We are applying the law to our business in a really concrete manner so that our stakeholders understand exactly what's at stake.
Wow, that is such a great, succinct way to put that. And I've heard that described from other people talking about working in-house and working for the business and needing to add value because you're no longer the product. but I love the way that you said that just now. So I'm going to leave that just how you said it because it was great. During the years, these initial years that you were at Shell, 2013 to 2016, I noticed that you were also incredibly involved in philanthropy and the Houston community. You are one of the reigning champions of the Houston. So you think Houston Dancing with the Stars, right?
People, I need to take that out of my bio. Everybody hones in on that, and yes, people that I can dance. I'm glad that this is a podcast because you're not going to make me do a dance move or anything. Dancing with the Houston Stars is something that I did for Urban Souls Dance Company, which is a Houston-based dance company that that does wonderful, wonderful work. But in addition to being a company where professional dancers can display their art, they also work in communities with kids and teach them how to dance and expose them to different forms of dance from early on. And that's what really inspired me to enter into the competition. And I ended up doing original Janet Jackson choreography from one of her music videos. And it was so much fun. But if I attempted any of those moves right now, I would need Icy Hot and Bengay and prayer as well.
That's fantastic. And I will go ahead and promise that I'm not going to go on YouTube and try and find any clips of this after we get done. But you were also involved with a lot of other charities as well. And so I'm curious how you balanced it all, because that is such an important part of a legal career, not just the work that you do, but how you give back to the community.
So I think that as attorneys, we are uniquely positioned to give back to our community. And it goes back to the message that my parents told me about making a better life for myself, right? So I knew that regardless of what other people were doing around me, I wanted to make sure that I used my law degree and the resources that I now had, financial and knowing about the law and other things, to give back to the community that supported me for so long. But I think your question's more about balance. And I really do think that work-life balance is somewhat elusive, but prioritization is what's paramount. When work needs to be done or you make commitments to people or organizations, you need to do what you say you're going to do. But I think it's important to always start with your why. Why are you volunteering? Why are you working for whatever organization? Why are you choosing to speak for whatever conference or whatever podcast? Why are you writing for XYZ publication? And make time for the things that are important to you, and make sure that you learn the power of saying no to things that are not important to you. And instead of work-life balance, I like to think about work-life integration. So whenever I get involved with a cause or a nonprofit or something that I like, I try to identify my friends who would also be interested in that same work that I'm doing in the community. So when I sat on the board of Bo's Place and ultimately became president of Bo's Place, I had several friends who were on the board of Bo's Place. Right now I'm the vice chair for the LGBT law section for the State Bar of Texas. Some of my best friends are also on that council. I'm the treasurer of the National LGBT Bar Foundation. Some of my best friends are on that board as well. So I think you really have to find the things that you like doing, do more of that, and do it with the people who you like. And I guess the only thing that I'll add, because my friends who hopefully they've made it this far in the podcast and they're still listening, they're probably laughing and saying, I can't believe she asked Travis the work-life balance question, because he is not equipped to answer it. He's always on working. But what I will add to it that's really important here is that self-care is important, and recognizing that you can't pour from an empty cup. That's also paramount. So if you're not taking care of yourself, nothing's going to be done well. But make sure you honor your commitments and understand what's important to you and do those things.
That's wonderful advice. Thank you for sharing it. I'm taking note of the time, and so I want to shift forward just a little bit, but I don't want to glaze over the fact that you were vice president of legal at Jiffy Lube, which is owned by Shell. So when you transitioned to that role, what was it like, and what were some things that you learned from that?
Being vice president of Jiffy Lube International was really the opportunity of a lifetime, because if you think about it, I was still a part of the Shell legal team, but I was the chief legal officer for this business unit that's owned by Shell. It's a franchise business with over 2,000 service centers across North America, 250 franchisees that own them. And that business, at least at the time, would serve over 20 million customers a year. And so the thing that was really, really cool about it is that I felt more like a business person who happened to have a law degree versus just like the lawyer in the room. I was working directly with the marketing team on what our brand and our commercials would look like. I was working on customer service metrics and customer service devices. I was working on strengthening our operations to make sure that they were top of the line for that industry. And on the legal side, what was really cool is that just like in my clerkship, I got to work on employment law issues, franchise law issues, antitrust, bankruptcy, and contracts. And that was all before lunchtime. Wow. Right. So when you were the chief legal officer of a company, you're seeing every single thing that that company is doing. And it was super interesting to be a part of it. But it taught me that I not only was a good technical lawyer, but I also had the commercial acumen as well.
Well, and one of the things I'm picking up on in your story is just how important a diversity of experience has been in your career and being able to see so many different things and how that has kind of helped build you into your current role now, which we're about to turn to. So tell us about what you do currently for Shell, what your role is there.
So right now, I am the Global Litigation, Bankruptcy, and Credit team lead. So I manage a small but mighty team of three people, and the help of an administrative assistant and a paralegal and a little bit of help out of Krakow and our Shell business office, we handle all of Shell's bankruptcy and credit matters that affect all of our lines of business in the United States and Canada.
Wow.
And so on, it's a lot. Yes. It really is a lot. And it's great that such a small team can handle all of this. But on the advice and counsel side, we are helping with all of the transactions that Shell Oil Company and its subsidiaries and affiliates are entering into, that range from other companies buying oil from us, us purchasing from some of the producers, companies that are building components for us to drill. We're trying to de-risk all of those transactions. On the bankruptcy and litigation side of that, think about when some of our counterparties end up filing bankruptcy. They either owe us money, sometimes we owe them money while they're in bankruptcy, or we have significant contracts and we need to protect Shell's interest in those contracts with those counterparties. So that's the quick and dirty of what my team does for Shell right now.
Which is a whole lot of stuff that your team does for Shell right now. So I'm curious, what's maybe one of the challenges that you've faced in this role that you've been in for a couple of years now, and how did you overcome it?
Well, this for me is the first time that I am directly managing a team. And the big challenge there is that I feel responsible for their development as professionals, their development as attorneys, their trajectory in the company, and their careers. And in some ways, because our team is so small, we're like family as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really, while I characterize it as a challenge, it's an opportunity. It's been a real opportunity for me to develop another set of skills. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that you realize is that, you know, like you, I'm a real person with feelings, ideas, thoughts, and opinions. And sometimes those are not necessarily entirely consistent with those of the organization that I work for. But I think that you really have to remain true to yourself while doing your job. But I found that being flexible, finding the common ground, and also staying authentic and putting my integrity first has gotten me through any challenges related to managing people. You know, I kind of think that, again, Maya Angelou, turning to her, it's really helped me along. She's known for saying that people will forget what you said and people forget what you did, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that you always have dignity and respect for people, that's imperative, especially when you're a manager.
Wow. And I think that actually really answers the next question that I had, which was just, you know, if you had a guiding principle in how you lead. And I think that
answers that so well and so profoundly. So thank you, Maya Angelou, for your genius.
Thanks again.
Thanks again to her. Well, that's really wonderful. I wanna shift just one more time, and then we're gonna wrap things up here, because I know I've had you on for a little while, and we're again so thankful for you giving us your time today. So you were recently appointed to the board of directors for the Texas Access to Justice Foundation, which provides grant funding for civil legal aid in Texas. I'm curious, for people in the legal field, what does it mean to get onto a board of directors? How do you go about that? And I know you've spoken to us a little bit about, you know, integrating work and life, and so doing things that you care about. So this is obviously something that you already care about. But what did it look like for you to get into this role and choose this, as much as you had influence to choose this?
Definitely. That's a really great question. And I think that board service happens for different people in different ways. The thing about AJAS is half of the board is appointed by the board of directors of the State Bar of Texas, and the president of the State Bar has a lot of say in and who those mm-hmm. individuals will be. The other half is appointed by the Texas Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and I'm one of the appointees from the Texas Supreme Court. I'm also a former member of the board of directors of the State Bar of Texas, but that's an aside. I think that the reason why I was chosen for TAJAF as a board member is I'm the immediate past chair of the Houston Bar Foundation's board of directors, and Houston Bar Foundation is the major funder for Houston Volunteer Lawyers, which is the pro bono arm of the mm-hmm. Houston Bar. And so I have experience with access to justice issues. I also helped TAJAF with its 35th anniversary celebration, which was the opportunity of a lifetime. We raised great money for access to justice. But the thing that I plan to bring to this role, I think, is, first of all, my experiences as a Black person, mm-hmm. but my experiences also as a part of the LGBT community here in Houston as well, and those experiences as the former chair of the Houston Bar Foundation. So mm-hmm. I understand the eviction issues that people are facing across our state. I understand the immigration issues. I understand the disaster relief that people need after storms have hit our area. And the work that TAJAF is doing, it's helping some of the poorest, most vulnerable people in Texas at their time of need. And so to be a part of this board, again, it's the opportunity of a lifetime. But to answer your question, for people who are listening to get involved, I think that your first step should be volunteering the organization and learning as much as you can about the work that the organization does. Learn about the people who are already involved. Because remember, work-life integration, you want to mm-hmm. spend your time with people you actually like. And as much as you end up giving to these organizations, you will get back so much more. In addition to the sheer altruism and the good feeling that you get from doing good work. Again, I've met some of the greatest friends of my life, but for your listeners who are still in law school, I'd encourage you to get involved in bar service and boards early on, because when I was that young associate at Fulbright who was kind of stuck in my office doing lots of research and writing, it was the Houston Bar Association that gave me the ability to be the chair of a committee. So mm-hmm. I got to learn how to run a meeting effectively and efficiently. When we started planning events, I took the helm of that. I learned how to plan an event. Then you're given opportunities to make remarks at different events. It really helped me to hone my public speaking ability. All of those soft skills right. that most law students are not learning in law school, and those opportunities that you might not get from early on in your legal career because you were doing the hard research and writing, those extracurricular activities, and I'm using air quotes, will give you some of those opportunities mm-hmm. because someday you will be the person who is at the podium making the argument in court if you're a litigator. Someday you will be the person who is leading the negotiations if you're a transactional lawyer. And you need to know how your voice is going to sound in a room. You need to know how to interact with people. And it's those experiences and nonprofits and boards and bar services that gave me those opportunities early on in my legal career. So I'd implore people to get involved as early as possible.
Wow, that is such fantastic advice, and I've definitely learned from similar experiences already in my legal career as well, and would just second that it is so important. And again, a great way to get connected in the community and make more mm-hmm. connections with others that potentially, you know, can become great friends or mentors or people that may help you along later in your career. So that is wonderful advice. And you've given us so much great advice today that I'm not going to ask you for any more, but instead going to turn to our final question, which we ask of every guest on our show. Are you pro Oxford comma or not?
So I'm a big fan of the show and I've listened to lots of the episodes, and for some reason, I knew you were going to ask me the question, but I didn't really think about it. This is my reaction. I'm a fan of the Oxford comma, and that's because I think that it can lead to confusion if you don't use it mm-hmm. and if you're an otherwise kind of lazy writer. The thing that actually drives me nuts, though, is when people sometimes use it and then they sometimes don't. So whatever you do, just pick a side and stick with it, right?
Yeah, I think commitment one way or the other is probably more important. And I will say I've actually been guilty during law school of riding the fence and doing it sometimes and others not. So I will take that advice to heart and apply it in my own writing. Well, Travis, thank you again so much for giving us out of your time today. I've loved hearing about your story, and I know that our listeners will love it as well.
The pleasure is all mine. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email us at emphasisadded@houstonlawreview.org. Follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at Houston L. Rev, or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.